We're back. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS. The horrific shooting early this morning in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, will likely leave more questions than answers, especially when it comes to trying to understand the mental state of the alleged shooter, James Holmes. To talk about what we've learned from previous mass shootings and the long-term effect to those that have survived these kinds of shootings, I'm joined by Michigan State University clinical professor of psychiatry and former mental health director for the state of Michigan, Dr. Frank Ochberg, whose expertise was called on during an FBI summit soon after the Columbine shootings in 1999. Dr. Ochberg, thanks for joining us on WILS.
I'm pleased to be with you. I'm sorry it's under these circumstances.
Once the shock and anger of today's shooting begins to wear off, people are going to want to understand why. Why would anyone walk into a theater and open fire on men, women, and children? Is there likely going to be any kind of clear answer?
Well, first of all, it's not as though there is an archetype, a single type of person who does this. There are strikingly different personalities and motives. And because this is in Colorado, 20 miles from Columbine, those people are going to be asking a lot of questions. I don't know a whole lot. I read that he's 24 years old. He's a medical student. Sounds like he's been smart. And sometimes in young adolescence, and 24 is still young, those are the ages when major mental illness can first come forth. And as a psychiatrist, I'd wonder if that plays a role. You also think, are there political motives, ideological motives? There was a horrible episode in Norway where Anders Breivik, who was an extremist, felt that he would make himself notorious, and he had a political point of view. And they're still debating whether he was technically insane or whether he rationally decided that he would kill to have his name and his mission blasted around the world.
Let me ask you, in the case of Columbine, obviously the two shooters did kill themselves. We saw that in Virginia also. Is there something to be understood from the fact that he did not attempt to kill himself and then submitted to police without any kind of a struggle?
Well, he could be compared in that respect to others who did not kill themselves and who were apprehended. Now, that was the case in Norway, and I've been taking a hard look at that case. There are a group of us who do something called critical incident analysis, where we try hard to put the facts together and to answer these questions, and certainly not to jump to conclusions, because there is a lot of irresponsible punditry on the part of people who think they know.
Well, let me ask you, though, if a shooter does this kind of an act and then does not kill himself, does that in some way show that he is potentially quite sane?
No, it doesn't. Sometimes the overall motive and profile is quite grandiose, and the person does want to go out in a blaze of glory, and they do what's called suicide by cop, and they take others with them. But I think here we have are hypotheses, mm-hmm. and we'll eventually learn.
Now, there are all kinds of horrible acts of violence, some that appear to happen spontaneously, others that show a lot of planning. In this case, he walked in with a bulletproof vest. He was heavily armed, apparently threw some tear gas out into the mm-hmm. into the audience. Those kinds of pieces of information, that kind of a planning, what does that tell us potentially about his mental state and his ability to think through this thing?
Well, you know, one thing it tells us is the movie didn't make it happen. And there are people who are thinking that films that have violence in them cause violent acts right away, spontaneously. So I would differ with people who would say that. I see now that there is fear of copycats, and there will be law enforcement officers in New York in showings of the same film. We know that there's a lot of security being prepared for the Olympics and questions about whether it's been adequately done. The questions that go through my mind, though, have more to do with the way loved ones handle the aftermath and with the difference between having a spree killing in an institution like a college or a high school or a workplace, or having it in a theater where there are a lot of strangers, and the theater itself is not a place where people can come back and can go through rituals of healing and understanding together.
I do want to ask you about the post-traumatic impact of this. I'm talking to Dr. Frank Ochberg. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Michigan State University and the former mental health director for the state of Michigan. Just one more question about these kinds of suspects and these kinds of shooters. You say it's a variety of potential profiles, but we do know it's men and it's young men in their 20s typically. Do you think that there is some ability or potential ability to identify these kinds of people before they act out?
Well, I wrote a couple of pieces inspired by previous mass killings, and I do think on some occasions we can identify people who are dangerous, and we're really perplexed in the best thing to do about it. And the example that comes to my mind is Mr. Cho at Virginia Tech. He was identified as having bizarre behavior, and he caused others in the college to be afraid of him. And he was evaluated, and he was found to warrant outpatient civil commitment. This means he was ordered by a judge to be in treatment, but he wasn't sent to a secure facility. Now, that's a very dicey situation. A person doesn't show enough mental illness or dangerousness to be locked up against his will, but enough to be compelled to be in therapy, and then we don't have a system to assure that the therapy goes on.
The frightening part is that you're saying these people are potentially mentally ill, but in a moderate way, in a way that the system can't readily potentially just pinpoint them right away.
Well, you know, they're mentally ill enough so that most professionals would apply a diagnosis. And let's say the diagnosis is schizophrenia. Most people with the diagnosis schizophrenia are not dangerous to others. But there are a few who are. They have hallucinations that order them to do bizarre acts. And they struggle with these hallucinations. And if you can establish the right kind of interaction and contact, as the Secret Service did in the day when I spent a year as an insider with the Secret Service, it is possible to have a combination of surveillance and calming contact and assurance that a person is taking medication. But we as a society have to decide that we're going to spend the money to do it right, and we're going to train people to do this.
In terms of the trauma to those who were in the theater and survived, what is the typical process now? How long of a period of shock is there? And the lifetime effect, is it really possible to fully overcome surviving this kind of a horrible incident?
Well, thanks. That's a That's a very important question. And now with troops coming home who've been exposed to gunfire and to death of their closest brothers and sisters in arms, we know that it's an issue. We know that if you're in a high war zone and you've been under fire, it's between 20 and 50% who are going to develop the post-traumatic stress injury. If you've just been in the theater, as Vietnam veterans, it was 15%. The journalists who go to war to cover war on a regular basis come back with 25% of them having this. And everybody is different. It may last a few months. To call it PTSD, it has to last at least a month. It means that you have nightmares or flashbacks or unwanted memories of the moment of horror. It comes back when you don't want it to. It also means that you're emotionally somewhat numb. And that's a sad part. These soldiers who tell me, I know that I love my daughter. I wish I could feel it the way I used to.
Tell me, when it comes to the therapy that we have, we certainly have all kinds of different techniques. Is there one that is especially effective in breaking people out of a PTSD?
It's more that there is an approach that's effective. I mean, if anyone wants to Google my name, O-C-H-B-E-R-G, and put next to it PTSD treatment, there's a whole outline on the web. But what I would disparage and discourage is the thought that there's one remedy that works for everything, like EMDR, or I have a counting method. There are tools of the trade that a good therapist knows how to apply and when to apply. And these tools help a person overcome their nightmares or overcome their anxiety, or through counseling, learning how to be around people who pick you up rather than people who put you down. So, yes, there is an overall approach, and post-traumatic therapy works, and it is definitely helpful, but there isn't a silver bullet, a magic bullet, or a single pill that takes it all away.
Is there any effective step a psychiatrist can help with initially, moments, days after an event like this, to help a victim recover in a faster way?
It's a good question, and there's research going on to see if you take certain kinds of medications that reduce your arousal right away, does it tend to prevent PTSD from happening in the first place? Right now, that is all experimental. There's nothing that you can take right away. And in fact, there was an approach that was done by colleagues of mine for many years called critical incident stress debriefing, and we've learned that that makes it worse. What you don't want to do is sit down with 20 other people who've had the same bad experience and hear all of their stories. It makes you feel good that you're part of a group that's gone through hell together, but what it does is it increases your trauma imagery load, and the risk of having PTSD, something that lasts for months and months, goes up rather than down. So right now, it's common sense. It's go where you feel safe, be surrounded by people that you care about and who respect you. Mm-hmm. Take your time to reduce your feeling of horror and terror in natural ways. Don't drink a whole lot. And if, as the weeks go by, you find that you're not getting better, get yourself a therapist who understands trauma and talk it through.
One last thing, the effect on the national psyche, do you view events like this as having a larger impact on the way people as a whole feel within the country about the safety that they themselves are potentially experiencing or the lack of it?
Well, you know what I'd say, and I like that question too. There is a temptation for people who think they know everything to go out and say everything and to have a single solution and to fan the flames of anxiety, or to come up with instant legislation that they think is a remedy for the last notorious case to come along. I mean, I would advise that we be sensible, we be calm, we do our best to balance our civil liberties and our freedoms and protect them. And we don't take an episode like this to say we're going to outlaw movies at midnight, or that we're going to blame the artists who create films for fomenting violence. That's not the case.
Dr. Frank Ochberg, he is a Michigan State University clinical professor of psychiatry, former mental health director of the state of Michigan. Dr. Ochberg, thank you for joining us and giving us your expertise this evening.
Well, thanks for inviting me, and I certainly hope that the families who were affected in Colorado have a decent recovery and understand that our thoughts are with them.
Thanks again. And we will be right back. I'm Michael Cohen. You're listening to 1320 WILS.